It is time for the Media Beat with David Terechuk. David, of course, joins us on a Friday morning. We rebroadcast David during the week in the noon hour, also on the weekend. And I do believe we have a plethora of items that we can discuss this morning. Good morning, David. How are you?
Well, hello. I'm back in the media capital of the world. And yes, it's been a week of head-spinning media events. That's not really quite the word, but things that grab our attention and make our heads spin, many of them. Yeah, we could pick almost anything out of the potpourri of nonsense and topsy-turvy and self-contradictory sometimes news feeds that there have been this week.
You know, we have to start off with what Boris Johnson did this week. And I do have to say, I don't know a lot about British history and about English lawmaking, but when I first heard about suspending Parliament, I decided to take it upon myself and look into it. And I was very, very...
About time, too. Everyone, I think, ought to know about British history. Don't you agree?
Well, I think that at least news organizations should, because hearing news organizations almost report like it was unbelievable that the Queen approved this. And that's one reason why I went and took a look at this. Of course she approved it, because it was presented to her in a perfectly legal way.
And that's her role. Her role is just to take the Prime Minister of the day's advice and act upon it. That's what a constitutional monarch in the British Constitution, unwritten as it is, as the news media keep reminding us, but unwritten doesn't mean it isn't based on precedent. Of course, it's based on precedent, and some precedents are kind of unbreakable. And one is basically that, not to put it too crudely, but the Queen does what she's told.
Well, that's it. But it seems like even I'm talking about all American media, not just the mainstream networks, but even NPR. The way they reported it, it was like, oh, they were almost all surprised that the Queen approved it, and that's where I guess I agree with Joe a lot, that people, if they hear something and it even raises their eyebrow a little bit, it's not that hard to investigate it and find out why something happened, because you're never going to understand what just happened or try to understand unless you know the history that leads up to why something like that can happen.
Well, obviously, yes. Context is everything, Jill is always reminding us, and context is usually historical context when it comes to public affairs. And sure, the Queen's position in Britain's rather odd constitution is not an easy thing to get and grasp in a moment, but it's, as I say, based on precedent. You can read about it. It is a matter of history, and we after all are one of the countries, rather like France, that at one point in its history chopped the head off their monarch. We had a revolution, although the French Revolution is probably more famous, but in a popular sense. We have a history of essentially putting checks and balances on our monarchs, and we're not a monarchy in the sense of an absolute monarchy anymore. We have this very peculiar but it could be unique. I'm not absolutely sure about that. I think there may be other constitutional monarchies that are so close to us, you might say they're the same, perhaps in Scandinavia, or Holland. It's a particularly historically conditioned constitution that works, or at least so far it has worked. It has been put under extraordinary strain by the Brexit story over the last 3 years. But it is there. You can read about it. And no great precedents have been broken by this. It's slightly unconventional, yeah, I would say, what Boris Johnson has done. And not just the fact that the Queen readily approved it. That's not the great surprise. The big annoyance that most British critics of the move by the new prime minister, the unelected prime minister. That's another odd factor, of course. People in Britain are still outraged that he should be playing fast and loose with conventional rules when he hasn't even been elected prime minister. But one of the things which is much more a reason for Brits anyway to be outraged by this, and why they are calling it a constitutional outrage, is that it reduces the time available for Parliament to take action in the checks and balances kind of sense of action against Boris Johnson as he hurtles towards coming out of the European Union without an agreement, without the detail of an agreement in place for how the divorce is supposed to take place. You know, every divorce has to have an agreement for it to happen, and he's suggesting that we at least prepare for the possibility, the strong possibility, he is heavily hinting, that there will be no agreement by the time we get to October 31st, when we're supposed to leave Europe completely. And his words, with an agreement or not with no agreement. So it's the no deal nature of the forces that are gathering now and taking advantage of the Prime Minister's ability to name the day that a Parliament will come back from its long summer vacation, and the extra tag-on vacation that they get every year at this season, for the parties to have their own conventions. And that's where the media have gone haywire, I think, is to say that this is an extraordinarily, like some of his critics have, an extraordinarily unconstitutional outrage. Well, what it boils down to, in actual practical fact, is that Parliament's time to do anything about what the Prime Minister is planning is reduced by effectively about 4 or 5 days. That's what's happened. So it's not as big a deal as the press and, of course, Boris's opponents are trying to make out, with all the huffing and puffing and outrage.
You know, what I look at, and maybe you can correct me, we have to educate a whole series of Americans to remember what the crisis with Northern Ireland was many, many years ago. And what really kind of brings the hair up on my neck is thinking about a hard Brexit and what happens. Are those posts put up back on the Northern Ireland border, which basically have held the peace for so many years now? You know, there's a lot of people in this country, I don't know about in England, about the young people that have grown up not knowing the violence and the death that occurred between Northern Ireland and the rest. Then this is going to affect that if it's a hard exit, isn't it not?
Yeah, it is, and that's one of the things that Boris Johnson is trying to ignore as a major risk. It's seen in Ireland, both sides of the border, the northern side of the border, which is for the moment at least still part of the United Kingdom, and south of the border, which is its own independent state, the Republic of Ireland. The concern is, of course, that we will see a return to the dark days where that border was extremely controversial and a gash across the country. It was created in 1921 by an old colonial British habit of drawing a line across a patch of land and saying, that's your border, folks. And it's been contested ever since. And it was a highly visible part of the, as you say, what the Irish themselves call, in a very typical Irish euphemism, they call the Troubles, that time from the 1960s right through until the end of the century, when we were in a state of one man I interviewed then, who was at the time Irish Republican Army, you know, in many people's terms, a terrorist commander in the eastern city of Derry, a man called Martin McGuinness. He said that my city, Derry, is in a state of complete war, total war, was his phrase, in the interview I did with him. And that was the nature of the conflict. It was a guerrilla warfare, but it was essentially a state of war. That same man, Martin McGuinness, eventually became, thanks to the peace agreement that was negotiated in the last 2-3 years of the century, what's called the Good Friday Peace Agreement, because the deadline for them reaching it was on Good Friday of 1998. He became, under that agreement, the second most important politician in the country. He became the deputy first minister, deputy to a man from directly the opposite end of the political spectrum. It was an extraordinary piece of peacemaking, helped by the Americans considerably. Bill Clinton was president at the time, and the person who chaired the negotiations for all of this was former Senate leader, Senator George Mitchell. So there's a lot invested in that peace agreement, and America itself is one of the guarantors of that peace. But part of the peace agreement was to essentially rub out, just erase, take a kind of pencil eraser to that map in practical terms. There is no evidence when you cross from one side of the border to the other now, and of course that means trade takes place openly and easily. There's nothing to mark that border except signs telling you if you're leaving an American city, you know, you see goodbye,
welcome to such and such
on either side of the poster. The threat of a hard Brexit with the imposition of a border again, because the two sides of the border after October 31st, under the current scenario, will still be in the UK, and the other side of the border will be still in the UK, but out of Europe. The other side of the border, the south side of it, will still be part of Europe. So inevitably, there's going to be some kind of customs posts, simply because that's the nature of a customs union. You know, if you're in it, you're in it. If you're out of it, you're out of it.
And you don't even think about it.
And so the idea that this hard border will come is of course raising the specter of a return to the violent time that that border did represent before, when it was a hard border.
But there's another, and this I am eternally grateful. I hate to say this to the BBC for the most illuminating video. Very quick, it'll suck up a whole 90 seconds of your time. But it shows also, and I encounter this with people with astrology all the time. They just expect that, the sign or the blank must change at 12:01 because, you know, that's when it's the new day. And, of course, it doesn't. There actually isn't one straight line. There are 5 or 7 places that just driving down one road, you are going into a country, out, you're going in.
The last thing that border is a straight line.
That's right.
I mean, there was a magnificently sharp piece of reporting from NPR, who sent their London correspondent across to Northern Ireland to see what the effect of this is. And at one point, just traced the notional journey, well, not notional, it's an actual practical journey of a milk truck, right. One of these big tankers, you know, that picks up milk from the farms of origin. It will pick up milk from a Northern Irish farm and then drive 300 yards, 300 meters, as they're saying, because, you know, distance is now pretty well Europeanized all across Europe, including the UK. 300 meters down the road, they're picking up milk from the, and putting it into the same tank, milk from Southern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. And then 300 meters further on, it's another Northern Irish farm that is contributing to the mix. So sure, as it progresses, turns into milk and turns into butter, that milk processing is now horribly complicated by the idea that there are two sides to this border again, in practical terms.
And this is why I just, again, I watched, and I seem to say this every week, and I apologize, but, you know, just the outrage. By the way, at some point, since you can't have outrage about everything, even though it seems, I'm hoping that it's just because it's August and the grown-ups are away, that every headline, the outrage, because it's becoming a bit tedious. But one of the things that is being masked with the outrage is whether or not talks are actually taking place, because it's so abundantly clear that yanking this apart is going to make its own gravy, and that's being really kind about it.
Yes, a lot of bubbles coming up to the surface, and a lot of stirring going on, of course. Yeah.
And it's anyone who's lived long enough is sort of going to know that the biggest problem over the last three, this is an oversimplification, but the biggest problem over the last 3 years was the stasis. You had basically Mrs. May's inability to negotiate. You know, she negotiated a deal, and her government
eventually, yeah.
Well, she did. She worked. Let's be really like third grade about this. She eventually negotiated a deal, and her government didn't accept it. So every time she brought it, they voted it down. Now,
the Parliament, which indeed is to what she reports to in the our British constitutional idea of checks and balances. Yeah, I mean she doesn't have an untrammeled authority. She reached this deal with her European counterparts, and she had to present it to Parliament, and they wouldn't have it, and that was the problem.
And that's, you know, it's a pretty simple equation. You go home, yeah, and there's no food in the house, and you're hungry. Okay, you know, like, yeah, how much reporting can you do on that? Somebody at some point is going to say, hey, maybe you should go to the store or find someone who can make you dinner or go out to eat. This is boring. So the long short is something had to be done to move this along. Now, meanwhile, and in my view, this was wickedly underreported, the EU making their deal, you know, it wasn't necessarily the greatest deal ever. It was the one she got, but the fact is, if you watch any sporting event, you know, you really shouldn't leave before the first half. You really shouldn't even leave in the third quarter. You should probably wait till the game is over. And in most negotiations, you do find that there's a flurry of activity at the very end when there's a deadline. And suddenly everybody is like, hey, I'll do this, you do this, you do this. We good? Good. Great. And that's, I'm mildly digressing, but that's one of the problems with having a four-year election.
Yeah, and in fact, that what you're describing there, that process, is exactly how the Northern Irish Peace Agreement was reached, by the way. The reason it's called the Good Friday Agreement is that they were under an awful lot of pressure to get everything done by a Good Friday. An awful lot of new concessions and compromises were hammered out in the last 36 hours of the very intense negotiations. Well, you know, that pretty well happens with every transnational negotiation the world over.
So when you take those, I think we can safely call them facts, right? And then
they keep repeating themselves, yeah. And that's where we are with the Brexit negotiations, an agreement, but it's not been ratified by the British Parliament, and indeed, you know, adding to the confusion, Parliament itself can't exactly agree on what kind of agreement it does want. So through this stasis, this logjam, we have seen the emergence of a new leader within the Conservative Party that is barely the majority party. I think Boris Johnson now has a majority in that parliament of one seat.
Right.
So he's now empowered, though that's a whole stretch of a word to you, empowered to make his own decisions about it, but still needs parliamentary approval. Now, how's he going to get it? Now he's trying to limit, although he claims this is not the purpose of his timing changes, but he's trying, but he, in effect, he's limiting the amount of time Parliament will have available to itself to approve, disapprove, or bring up an alternative to what he plans to do. He's because of the outrage, as everyone is almost everyone is describing it, he's actually had to walk back his announcement of the change of times, but he's not changing the dates involved. What he's done, and I think this, you know, your point about there never being complete stasis here, and there's always, especially towards a deadline, a hard and fast deadline, there's always some wiggle room. What he's made clear is that this, I'm not going to change the number of days that Parliament has to try and stop me, but what I am going to do is redouble my efforts to talk to Europe. And there are talks going on. There are talks every twice a week, in fact, is the practicality of it. So out of those talks may come up something different. It's just possible that we have a deal as the clock ticks by down to this deadline. As I think you're so often asking for, we could just say to the British public and the British media, hey, just calm down a minute. You know, there may be still some room for a different kind of agreement to emerge. And of course, in Europe, everyone's saying, well, that's not possible.
Yeah,
Europe
nonsense.
Has come to the end of its list of possibilities in terms of what it can offer a UK that wants to get out. But we know what these hard and fast lines that are drawn in negotiations mean when it comes to crunch.
And I want to, you know, to people who are listening saying, why are we talking so much about Brexit? Well, the important thing about Brexit and what Americans need to understand is that with uncertainty in economic markets all over the world, the last thing in the world you need is something like Brexit done an inconceivable way, whether it happens or not, is the last thing the world economy needs, one way or the other, right now. I mean,
in a word or two, world markets are jittery enough at the moment. as has been evident by just the stock market's reaction in right across the board, even to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and of course there the atmosphere is even more jittery for its own reasons. But we've seen how nervous the world markets are, and that will give us some kind of inkling of what could happen if things go belly up on October 31st in Britain and Europe.
The other reason we're talking about it is because we could replace Brexit for pretty much anything that's being covered anywhere by our.
Oh, it's an object lesson in media coverage.
So that's the
emotional response. That's
the reason that I'm actually talking about it. And I mean, we could replace it with Hong Kong. By the way, did you know that bail was granted? Does anyone? Is it just me? You know, who sits here on Monday watching, you know, the American media group or whatever, yanging about tariffs and how the world is ending. Did anyone notice as the army, you know, the rotation of forces came in, that what we weren't talking about was how the link between what was going on, the protests in Hong Kong and the tariffs were completely decoupled. Completely. It's like, oh, yeah. Absolutely. And meanwhile, you know, here we get to this, and anyone who is samples news will know that there were some arrests last night, and the march for tomorrow or today. What time is it? It's Friday night.
It's already today, and yeah.
You know, it's tonight. So anyway, tomorrow, Saturday's march.
They've canceled.
Has been canceled, yeah. But the people who were arrested have been released. They've been bailed.
I've been They've been bailed, yeah. And the courts, still largely influenced by the British colonial heritage, are still an independent entity. And sure, just because the government's police force goes out and arrests a bunch of people doesn't necessarily mean that that's the end of the matter.
Right.
Indeed, yeah, there's an independent court system, and we'll see how that plays out.
Right, and it's interesting that it's been adjourned until November 8th. So you see, right, so again, and this is what I was so pleased that you and Marshall were talking about at the beginning of the show. It's not just the context. It's that if you're going to consume news, and everybody has now, it's unavoidable, then you're going to
It's certainly hard to hide from, yeah. And every now and again people do. And in fact, I continue to advise, take a break.
The whole thing is, in today's, and this is where I totally agree with Jill, news isn't news any longer with social media. News has become entertainment. In social media,
and infotainment,
ghoulish kind of infotainment.
It's like my father used to say. It's like going to my father could never understand a demolition derby with the A-track, where cars specifically were going to crash into one another. And he used to say, when I was a kid, and I'd be watching that with my grandmother, this is going to things like this is going to lead to the downfall of civilization, because everything is made to be entertainment and shock and shock and awe inspiring nowadays, and it's not just news.
Yeah, well,
anymore.
Every news broadcast is a form of watching demolition derby. That's true. Yeah.
And that I don't know how much more time we have, but
we have about a minute and a half.
So I was talking to somebody, again, I don't worry about you, I don't worry about Marshall, I don't worry, because we're old and we know what to do. What I worry about are my 26, 27, 28-year-olds who basically pick up their phones or their devices or whatever in the morning, and the next thing you know, they're involved in a discussion, is such the wrong word, on climate change, which is really not going to be solved. It's not going to do anything except mess up a bunch of people's heads if that's what happens when you pick up your phone. You know, it doesn't lead to reasoned discourse. It leads to just all bunch of words I can't say on the radio. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there was, we can find examples of the nonsense that passes for news, and even more outrageously misnomered is the idea of news analysis, which both in print and in those shouting matches which count as discussion on cable news. But that's what passes for news and news analysis now. It's a process, and it's a self-replicating process right across the board, and that's what, for the moment, we're stuck with. And you're right. I mean, our responsibility is to a rising generation of people who have been reared on this and know nothing else. That's a terrifying prospect.
But it's one that we're going to work on. It's sort of like being reared on processed food. At some point, you're going to have to just have a piece of chicken. Or something.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very
much. Without antibiotics.
Yeah, exactly. And genetic modification. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, the Media Beat.
Thank you.